Welcome to the June 17th meeting of the Kitsap Planning Commission. Thank you for your attendance. We'll start with introductions. Can we have the Zoom introduction first? David?
David Bleek, North Kitsap.
Starting on the right.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Tammy Bowen, North Kitsap.
Good evening. Richard Shattuck, Central Kitsap.
Alan Beam, Central Kitsap.
Ashley Hall, South Kitsap.
Caleb Nelson, South Kitsap.
This will be a hybrid meeting. Please silence all electronic devices during the meeting. If you're attending in person, please refrain from conversations with other attendees or staff during the meeting. If you wish to provide general public comment or testify during the public hearing, we have four methods available. First is virtual attendees can raise their hand at the appropriate time using the raise hand button at the bottom of the Zoom window. Your name will be called and the microphone will be unmuted. Next, call in attendees can signal by pressing star 9 on their keyboard. Their last four digits of the phone number will be called and you will be connected. You may have to dial star 6 to unmute your phone. Next, written comments, testimony can be submitted to the staff or emailed to cjewel@kitsap.gov by 2 p.m. of the day prior to the meeting. Please include the date of the meeting, for which you have comments, your name, the agenda item, and the subject you're addressing. Submitted comments will be entered in the record at the appropriate time. For all speakers, please state your name and the general area in which you live. Comments are normally limited to 2 minutes for general public comments and 3 minutes for a public hearing. These times are adjustable by the chair. Next item is adoption of the agenda.
Mr. Chair, I move we amend the proposed agenda to reflect that the adoption of minutes for the June 3rd, 2025 meeting not be considered tonight and be deferred to our next meeting.
Second.
Do we have any discussion? Hearing none, agenda is approved. That leads us to first general public period, comment period. Do we have any comments from the room? Seeing none, do we have any comments on Zoom? Seeing none, we'll close the first general comment period. That leads us to the findings of fact for the Recreation Open Space PROS plan.
Great. Good evening, commissioners. For the record, my name is Carmen Smith, parks planner, and we'll be here to discuss the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space, or PROS plan, findings of fact. Just as a quick refresher, this is our fifth meeting before the Planning Commission. We met with you to have a briefing, and then a work study. And then a work study and public hearing, and then a couple weeks ago we walked through deliberation. So, Claire, if you could pull up the findings of fact, please, we can run through that briefly. Thank you. So Section 1, General Findings, lays out the requirements for the PROS plan and growth coming from the State Growth Management Act, but also the state's Recreation and Conservation Office requires that jurisdictions update their PROS plans every 6 years. Last update was completed in 2018, so we are due for an update, and the PROS plan will be adopted by reference into the comprehensive plan. Section 2, if you could scroll down, please, General procedural findings talks about the outreach and the process that the department took in developing the plan. Lots of outreach opportunities, and then ultimately the plan was released. A draft plan was released February 10th for a five-week public comment period. We received a number of comments, made a number of edits in response to the comments that we received, and then began our planning commission process. So the dates there are the meeting dates for the meetings I mentioned earlier, as well as our SEPA determination from DCD and our consistency review with the comprehensive plan also with DCD. I think if you could scroll, please. Section 3, general substantive findings, talks about the PROS plan's consistency with the comprehensive plan, and then leads into the recommendation from the motion that was captured at deliberations, as captures the amendment made by the Planning Commission and approved by the Planning Commission. If you would scroll down. And then, oh, actually, if you could go to the other document, please. We also just wanted to provide the other, yeah. Thank you. We wanted to provide the amendment so you could see it as written. And we also provided the updated PROS plan that includes that updated language as well. But this is an easier way to just quickly look at the amendment. Great, thank you. If you wouldn't mind zooming in a little bit, if we can. See. But in red, underline shown is the new sentence that was added to that section in the inventory and assessment on page 15 of the plan, and it talks about wildfire smoke's impacts on outdoor recreation. So, like I said, that's been updated in the plan as well, but just wanted to provide it here so you could see what that amendment looked like. I want to thank you all for your time and review of the PROS plan.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the findings of fact, conclusions, and recommendation for the PROS plan as presented by staff.
A second.
Discussion? I think we should probably vote. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of approving the PROS plan? Opposed? Plan passes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have a briefing on sea level rise and threat and risk.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Jim Rogers with DCD Long Range Planning, and I have with me here tonight Dawn Spilsbury of FACET. She is a consultant that has worked long and hard over the past year on this sea level rise vulnerability and risk assessment for us. This project wraps up at the end of this month, and today we're going to present to you a pretty comprehensive overview of the final document. And so hopefully you've got some questions along the way. And if Don can get a clicker there to run this thing, that would be great. And then I think you can turn your microphone on there. There you go.
It's red. That yep. Indicates. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having us. And so I am the ecologist and GIS analyst that was working on this project. And online should be Alexandra Plum. I'll just do her introductions, and then we'll get to her. She'll speak on, she's our planner, and so she will speak on the mitigation strategies and adaptation strategies and recommendations at the end. So I get to tell you all about the fun mapping stuff, and she gets to tell you about all the work that we need to do still. And please ask questions along the way. We're happy, you know, to stop and answer as we go, so. Pointing at yours, probably, eh? Maybe. Oh, probably have to turn it on. Oh, lies. There we go. Haha. No, that's okay. So what we'll talk about tonight is the vulnerability assessment results, and then, like I said, we'll go to Alex and she'll discuss the adaptation strategies and some next steps, and then discussion. I neglected to find out how much time you want us to talk for. I can go fast because I can talk fast. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, all right, great. So let me just skip forward right quick here. All right, so I was expecting there would be a little bit more lead-in. I don't know what happened to my slides, but we're going to go with it. So we worked with the Technical Advisory Committee for this, and they were the ones that kind of guided our decisions and what assets should be looked at. So briefly, what the vulnerability assessment is we chose scenarios, sea level rise projection scenarios, and those are represented. The amounts that we mapped are here, and I'll explain how we got to these and where this data comes from. And then we take those, we create a map, an inundation layer, and then that gets overlaid with assets that we care about, and we're going to talk about what those were, and then we just see what might be impacted. And that's the exposure risk, or the likelihood of exposure by a certain time under a certain scenario, which was a decision. So it doesn't mean, so this, again, this is just a planning level. This is not a regulatory layer, because had we chosen a different time frames or certainty levels, that would mean a different sea level rise. And also there's lots of variance and confidence intervals around these numbers. And then what we did is we'll get into that rule set and such, but to do the vulnerability matrix and a vulnerability assessment of those assets, and then we looked to the other information to see how we could address those vulnerabilities for you, or what the recommendations would be to you all for that. So these numbers, the top box, the little box, is the projected sea level rise for mean high water, daily high tides, basically, by those states. So we're fortunate in the Puget Sound that we have some really great projections. Projections just meaning these numbers in front of you, not estimates, that's kind of the wrong connotation. But and they were developed by Dr. Ian Miller and his team from the with Washington Sea Grant. And the Climate Impacts Group from UW is also involved. But there is a website that you can go and look, a visualization tool, and you can choose your certainty, so how certain you want to be that these projections are going to happen. So 90% means you're really pretty sure this is going to happen. Those numbers tend to be smaller. 50% is the standard that most jurisdictions look at, because it means simply we're as likely to see this as we are not likely to see this, so kind of middle ground. And then 1% is where you map to make sure that you are covering the worst case scenario. So they tend to be pretty high. You can go by years, and the TAC here, the TAC being the Technical Advisory Committee, chose to look at 2050 and 2100. And again, with that tool, you can go and look at different numbers as well, but this is what we looked at. So the top represents the, like I said, the everyday high tide estimate. So, you know, we're likely as not to see a one foot over mean high by 2050. SLR is sea level rise. So sorry about that, sea level rise projections. The bottom table is the extreme storm. So these numbers are higher, but this is storm surge. So this is a temporary inundation. So this is what is going to be pushed onto land based on historical tide gauge references with storms. So all of this work is cited in the Sea Grant documents, and they're linked in the report. There's the citations, but we also, the story map that we're developing has those links. So residents in the county can go and click and look at that work and all of the detail behind it. Another quick thing with these numbers, Dr. Miller took into account, this is also with a relative concentrated pathway, RCP, of 8.5, which is the business as usual. RCP 4.5 would be if we had kept greenhouse gases down and we were going to meet that no increase above larger than 2 degrees by a certain time frame. That comes from the International Climate Change Report, the ICPP. So the TAC suggested to look at the 8.5% RCP, relative concentrated pathway. Lots of different numbers. The nice thing about being able to choose your numbers like this is that if you're going to build a hospital that's going to be around for 100 years, very critical infrastructure, look at a 1% certainty. If you were looking to put in a park and a gravel pathway, you could look at a 90% certainty because there's less risk with that. So that's why this is structured like this. And we're really lucky Washington's got this. Oregon doesn't have this that I know of. Yes, sir.
Don, everything you're saying makes sense, except I don't understand what we're at on a 50-year storm. So I know what that means. You know, it's raining and it floods.
Yes.
I do have experience, for example, in Seabeck a couple of years ago. We had king high tides,
okay,
and we had some wind coming in, not a huge storm,
yes,
and it inundated the downtown marina area. Mm-hmm. There. Was that a 50-year storm? Do we have something I can go and say, here's the 50-year
the
storm, so you
of
can
it.
Think about it?
Yeah. I wish I had that reference on your shoreline to be able to tell you at a 50% storm at well, actually, we do. We have the maps. in Hansville, yeah. So you'll see in the maps what a 50-year return storm, how far that could come inland.
Okay.
Those numbers come from the historic tide gauge range. And so they look at the storms, the highest tides of the year, including the storms, including king tides, and what that looks like over a trend. And then they can look to see how frequently does it get this high. Is it once every 50 years on average? That's your 50-year return frequency. Is it a little bit 20 years? And then there's the 100-year or every 100-year return.
And so it's just a function of the height of the tide. It doesn't take into account low pressure.
Yeah, no, it is. So the storm is all of those factors that create that storm. What it does not, so this would be a lot of rain, a lot of pressure, king tides, low pressure, so the seas rise up. What it does not include is wind wave run up. So because these numbers are derived from historic tide gauges, which are off land, not on land, and so there's all of that stuff that happens between with the waters and the wind wave push and run up over the surface, and so all of that is not accounted for in these numbers. There is an appendix and a summary, an appendix to the report and a summary in the report. Blue Coast Engineering, their coastal geomorphologists, worked with us, and they did a wind wave run-up look. Problem is it's really hard to map wind wave run-up, so we looked at it they did seven, I think, transects, including Hansville and Port Gamble and Gorst and some other areas to see how far farther with winds pushing it does it go than this high tide or during a storm. And so I tried to map it, and I got corrected by the geomorphologist and said, no, you can't do that. It's very dependent on what buildings are in the way, what surface roughness is there, is it going up and over curbs. Anything that can disturb the waves from getting forward will change. So it's a very site-specific phenomenon. So,
hey, Don?
Yeah, Alex?
Greg has his hand up. I think he wanted to chime in.
Oh, Greg, I didn't know you were online. Speaking of our geomorphology expert specialist, Greg, please. He's the one that did our work.
I just want to chime in on the question about the storm return interval. Just for reference, the really high water level that occurred, the extreme water level that occurred in December, it was December 27th, 2022, that exceeded the 100-year return interval. Water level at the Seattle tide gauge because of the atmospheric effects combined with the already high astronomical high tide on that.
Thanks for checking, Greg. So that was that was exceeded in a 100-year storm, 100-year frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Greg Curtis is with Blue Coast Engineering, so he was the one that did the extra work for us. Sorry, Greg, I didn't see you there.
No problem.
So wind wave run up, king tides are included in these numbers. These numbers are taken and put on top of the high tide the high tide, the SLR projection number, and that's how we get to what this would look like by 2050 is what those are. Yeah, 2050 or 2100. A quick aside is that there's rulemaking currently going on right now with Washington Department of Ecology with some guidance. It's not finalized yet, but it's going to be asking or directing jurisdictions to look at. They're getting very specific about what they want jurisdictions to map and look at for hazard areas. I believe we have you covered with these numbers. They want you to look at a 2050, 2100, and a 50-year. So I believe that you guys, that the county will be covered. We'll see where the rulemaking lands. It's all in draft. So that was good news. There was one other point I was going to make with these numbers. Commissioner. Yes, sir.
Did you look back 50 years and see how the last 50 years work into this prediction? Is there any consistency between sea level rise for the last 50 years to the projected sea level rise for the next 50 years?
So consistency, no, sadly. But the work that Dr. Miller did to get to these numbers does do that. It looks in the past at the tide and at the tide gauges for sea level rise, but plus of the storms, and then watches the trend from the storms go back almost 100 years for a lot of the tide gauges. And then I'm trying to remember what year. That's in the report too. He's got a really good graph, and it shows where the tides were generally and how the average tides are increasing. But then it goes into a hockey stick kind of idea in the future. That is a combination of things, but it is going to be the warming of the oceans, which cause expansion. As they absorb more heat from the atmosphere, the water molecules get bigger. If we have excessive melt on our polar ice caps, that adds more fresh water, and it comes more water from the land currently into the ocean, which also raises it up. So those projections are from the IPCC, and Greg or Alex can look that up right quick, but the International, trying to remember what the acronym is, International Something for Climate Change, but it's an international science consortium that looks at these projections. And
Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Thank you. Thanks, Alex. So that document that Dr. Miller put together has a lot of that explanation on it. Back to that historical science and what drives these numbers. I know the other thing that I was going to mention about these, another important thing, these numbers take into account tectonics. So this is called relative sea level rise. So we know the seas are expanding, luckily not as fast here as they are in the East Coast, but they are coming up. And then his team looked at how fast the land is moving in relation to the sea. So because we are in an active seismic area, as the fault, as the Pacific plate slides under the North American, the edge of the North American is coming up. And so Nia Bay is rising faster than sea level rise. Olympia is sinking faster than Port Townsend and here. So we're talking, it's not very much, but it's enough that it impacts it. So also glacial isostatic rebound, which is as the crust of the earth is coming back up from underneath the glacier weight as the glaciers receded. That amazed me. I didn't even know that was a thing, even through all of my science degrees. and that's small, but it's still there. So he's taken that, we've taken that into account as much as possible too. So that's why these numbers are relative sea level rise. The mapping we do is a bathtub model, which means we just look at this and add on current mean high water, which is NAVD, 8 or 9 feet, depending where you are here on the Kitsap County shoreline. It's 9 feet in Gorse and 8-something in Hansville, I believe. Lost my train of thought on that, trying to remember the numbers. Well, it'll come back. So anyway, I'm going to move on if there's no other question about the mounts that we mapped. Okay. Oh, yes, I'm sorry, the bays. Why do we have so many rows in that second table? So the historic trends in the tide gauges on land, but the work that Ian Miller did in the 2019 report about extreme coastal weather and coastal storms, has evidenced, and they showed that the tidal heights, the storm heights, are higher in the bays because of a magnifying effect. So the outer, you know, through Agate Pass, Okay, so up near Point No Point, you'll have a rise during a 2050 storm with a 50-year return frequency. It'll be about 3.5 feet extra above current mean high. But in Liberty Bay, Port Gamble, Agate, and Sinclair, it concentrates a little, and you get an extra 0.5 foot. And it's always done that in these bays. So they've always been a little bit higher in storms than the outer coast outside of the bays. So that is why these have got extra numbers and mapped in there. These numbers are rounded to the nearest 0.5 foot, because it's just because of resolution and mapping, it is easier and is within the confidence interval tolerances just to map this at this resolution. So I believe, you know, so it could be the number, that 0.5 foot for the 90% certainty in 2050 could actually be 0.4 or 0.37. I can't remember off the top of my head, but we round to 0.5. Yes, sir.
Let's just pick the first column at the 50-year return, 90% certainty. Is the 3.5 or the 4.0, is that a plus? That's how much it will increase?
Yeah, so by 2050, we are 90% certain that a 50-year return flood storm, a 50-year storm, would result in 4 feet or 3.5 feet. Above current mean high.
An increase in the next 25 years from today, 2025. Mm-hmm. So then why
the normal storm, though, the normal 50-year storm, right now, the 50-year storm would be about 3 feet above mean high. These storms are added on top. The storm amounts that we see historically are just added on top of the sea level rise.
It's an increase of. Right. So how do we understand in projection mode that in the next 25, let's just pick Liberty Bay, because okay. I live in Poulsbo.
Okay.
It says in the next 25 years, there will be a 4 foot increase in this occurrence.
There will be a half foot increase in this occurrence. Right now, the 50-year storm in Liberty Bay is 3.5 feet above mean high.
Okay, so it's a 0.5 foot increase.
Yeah.
Okay, because yeah. I was about to get...
really panicked? Yeah.
Well, no, just not panicked. The question was, why would it go up 4 feet in 25 years and then only one more foot right. in the subsequent 50 years? That's where the math wasn't working for me.
Yeah, because I didn't explain it very well.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So to do an assessment, we wanted to try and get to the point where we had a high, medium, low kind of ranking, so to speak. It's not a criteria, not a numerical criteria, but like a judgment on these. So we could try and figure out what we should be looking at first and what should be addressed, where our high needs are. So the exposure is simply how likely is that asset to come into contact with saltwater by our projected time date. The adaptive capacity is how resilient that is to that asset is to the seawater, and then together those create a vulnerability rating. And this is following the NOAA's model, the vulnerability assessment model that the Department of Ecology wants us to follow. So we created rule sets for each of the assets, and this is the exposure criteria. So this is a generalized one. Each one has, there's one for roads, there's one for structures, there's one for drinking water wells, that kind of thing. So this is generally what they look like. So the more likely it is to be exposed, the higher the ranking is, the exposure criteria. The adaptive capacity criteria was also applied. This is a little bit weird in that low is red, and that's because something that has low adaptive capacity or adaptability is just more likely to be damaged. So drinking water systems are low adaptive capacity. They're hard to move once you've got wells or drinking water infrastructure. And if you have an interruption in your drinking water, it's a pretty catastrophic thing. So it's low adaptive. It's got a low adaptive capacity. Parks generally are higher. So that's why this weird coloring. But Alex and I have struggled with how to represent this better. And even the NOAA's guidance struggles with it a bit. So, and this is a more subjective. This is not mapped. This is subjective. And all of this has been run by the Technical Advisory Committee as well. They approved our assets, and then they have reviewed our results as well. So the vulnerability matrix, we can take those two results, and then that's how we get to that. So each of the assets has a table in the report, and it gets really, really long. Wind wave modeling. Greg, I mean, I might be putting you on the spot, but if you want to explain this anymore, please come off mute and explain it. But the wind wave, well, I should ask you first before I try and explain it.
Well, yeah, so this is a very simplistic kind of planning exercise, but we wanted to look at wave run up in some of the low-lying coastal areas around the county. So we selected a number of sites, kind of tried to get a representative selection of sites around the county shoreline. And then we did a simple, what we call 1D wave analysis, no fancy 2D computer-aided modeling, just kind of a Excel spreadsheet with to get estimates of waves based on the nearest wind station, and then we calculated wave runup on a transect. So it's adding instantaneous vertical wave runup extent on top of those still water levels that Dawn was talking about. So this is to kind of give an idea of how much additional flooding could happen if we have a sea level rise and extreme water level event plus a very extreme windstorm occurring at the same time.
And so, Greg, how we read this chart, too, right, is that so in Hansville, we can say that in addition to the high storm level, it could go another 4 feet approximately inland in places on that transect.
Yeah, it's vertical feet, so it depends on the topography exactly how far inland it goes.
I think it hits in Hansville specifically, it hits the bluff, I think, first. It doesn't go inland, it just gets deeper.
And these are also this is a pretty low probability event, because this is, we used a 100-year wind wave, I believe, and on top of a 100-year, a 50-year extreme water level. So those two combine at the same time. And this is a kind of worst case scenario of coastal flooding.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for being, let me put you on the spot like that.
Sure.
And Blue Coast also took a look at bluff erosion. We still don't have great numbers or certainty around how to quantify sea level rise is going to impact bluff erosion. We have long-term bluff erosion rates based on historical data, but the problem with the characterization of bluffs and sliding is that a lot goes at once, but very rarely. And there's some that trickles off, at a slower rate, but it's hard to quantify where those big events are going to happen. We know that just structurally, the more you put waves in the bottom of a toe of a bluff, that you're going to, you can cause some small amounts of erosion there, which would cause the weight and the structure of the bluff up top to slide, but we don't know the rates. So what Blue Coast did for this report was to try and characterize that. And the mitigation components to that, I think we have that included in the mitigation strategy part, so I won't get ahead of us there. All right, that was the complicated part of the talk. Now we get to talk about results. So yeah, we did it. Okay. It's much more straightforward here. So from this point forward, so these are the list of assets that the Technical Advisory Committee wanted us to look at. So these are the things that we used GIS data from the county or Department of Ecology, Parks, DFW. Who else do we use? Department of Health. So we sourced all that information and mapped it. Oh, that's a really hard slide to read. Luckily, it's all in the report. but the roads. So this is what these vulnerability assessments look like. The exposure on the roads at the top are the ones that are likely to come into contact with saltwater at a 3.5 to 4 foot elevation. Road beds are not surveyed. No, we did not apply survey grade statistics to this. This is based on the LIDAR, Digital Elevation Model, DEM. And so when we looked at the LIDAR work that we did in Pacific County with WSDOT information and to test this methodology, it worked out quite well. WSDOT's surveyed roadbed elevations actually matched LIDAR really well because LIDAR's laser measuring the surface. So we've got pretty good confidence, but do know that it's not surveyed data. And maps are easier to read than that. So the roads that are likely to be most impacted are the ones are in a few concentrated areas. Luckily, we're not going to be showing you anything that's going to be a surprise here to you all. Everything that you're going to see that is likely to flood already floods at extreme storms, like in 2022. So nothing is going to be a surprise. All this, what we try to do is just put some time frames and some probabilities around it to help with organizing future work, whether it be on the capital improvement plans or maintenance schedules or emergency management work. So Southworth, this was a surprise to me, maybe because when I lived here, I was more Bremerton and Suquamish, and in between that area, I didn't spend a lot of time in Southworth. So I was kind of surprised that there was so many low roads down in Southworth, including the bridge there. So let's see. These were another area. These were interesting in that the one to the point there is would cut that area off if that is road is inundated. So they don't have another way off that road, off that point. And same with Keyport. The bridge that goes into Keyport is may be impacted. This report also we did not look at assets in any of the incorporated areas, the cities, or the Navy. We did not map sea level rise inundation in the on the Navy properties or Bainbridge Island. Everybody else has got inundation. Oh no, maybe we didn't do Paulsbo or Bremerton. No, those were cut off as well. I think we've got that available to them, and they were involved on the attack. But this was for unincorporated and the tribal reservations. And I should say also the tribes have their own sea level climate change assessment reports. They've been doing a really great job with that, so those are available. This is Silverdale. This part in Silverdale was interesting as well as far as impacts. This is the area in Silverdale that is got the most impacts, whether to roads and other assets, is coming up. Also, and this is Gorse. Let me go back because Gorse is going to distract us a little bit. So this map, and I don't know why it's so washed out, but I guess so. The yellow and the orange and the red, the yellow color is the 90%. By 2050, and the orange is the 50%, and the red is the 1%. The blues up behind it are the blues and purplies are the floods, the flood levels. So, okay, Gorse. This was a surprise to us too, because during our public outreach, we heard a lot of concerns about the roads in Gorse and that Gorse was going to flood. But the mapping didn't result in that. There is some road vulnerabilities here, but the yellow roads are with a really high tide. That's like an 8 or 9 foot inundation, like a storm, an extreme storm. So the red is a 3 to 4 foot. So the flooding that's happening here is likely stormwater and not tidal inundation. That should be probably vetted in a future phase. So yeah, quite surprised that that didn't show more and farther inland impacts. Before we leave roads, does anybody have any questions about roads? Yeah. Oh, yeah. The question was, maybe we should explain a little bit about stormwater and compound flooding when it hits there. Yeah, and we've got the stormwater. I'll explain that when we get to the stormwater facility. So thank you. Yeah, thanks. So airports and facilities, good news. It's great. It's good news. There's nothing with a risk exposure under our mapped scenarios. So we didn't map the 100-year storm, but everything is higher in elevation. Luckily, that's where Kitsap's topography and the bluffs really help, actually. There's not a lot that is low and down along the surface, relatively. It feels like it to the people that live there, I'm sure, though. Coastal buildings. So there are 1,190 buildings or structures, and that comes with a caveat, that are likely to be inundated by coastal flooding by sea level rise or by a 50-year return extreme flood by 2050 with a 90 or 50% probability. That buildings number comes from building footprints data. Sometimes the building footprint data, because it was remotely sensed, it's from an external data source we got from Microsoft, actually. That's what I believe all the jurisdictions, except for King County, who can map their own kinds of things with magic, it seems. But that data set will often, not often, has, and I've caught it a couple of times, will put a building structure on each side of a roof, because half of a roof is dark, half of a roof is light, and it looks like two different structures in the remote sensing, and it hasn't been, nobody's gone structure by structure to proof it. I started to do that in Hansville, and I realized did not have the time or the scope to do all 1,200 or actually 3,000 buildings. So that number is high, is my point. Also, it could be a house plus a detached garage plus a well house. So that's why we say structures. It doesn't mean residences. And we did not define between residences and commercial buildings or businesses that are permanently. And nor did we look at second homes versus that are only occupied during the summer when you're less likely to get hit with storms or permanent residences. So we did not look at that either. So, and these are all concentrated. These high exposed houses are concentrated in only a couple of places. Although that map makes me look like a liar. but this is the top half. And I just learned too. We were just talking about this at the GIS conference today about biases. These houses' symbols are really big. So it makes it look like there's a lot of coastal inundation problems here. And it overrepresents it, I think. Hansville, obviously, is a problem. We know that. There is some concerns, too, in the Miller Bay area. The other point about this data as well, which is easier when you get into the web map and kind of scroll down in and look, is that the houses... Oh, no, I'm going to back off on that. That was a different data set that I was thinking about. Sorry. I was thinking about parks. We'll get there. And again, this is only planning. This is not for insurance. It's not for permitting. It's not regulatory. These should be surveyed. These houses might not be at any risk at all. It just means that where the GIS data looked at it, there's a pixel that came into contact with one of the mapping pixels. So this is just to give a sense. So people that are going to look at these maps, if they drill down to their parcel and they see that, their house is red, then, you know, that, and we've tried to add the caveats in the web map as well about that to help people understand what this data is and what it isn't. Historical and cultural sites. This does not represent the tribe's cultural resources that they hold privately. But it does have Doke Gwats, is considered an area. We used the historic places, the state registered register of historic places. So it's Old Man House site, Point No Point Lighthouse, and Doke Gwats are the three areas that with high exposure. And we consider those all high vulnerability because it's really, they're not very adaptive. You can't move them and the or reduce their cultural sensitivity. So with mitigation. This is good news, Gray. Gray's good. PSC substations and structures, there weren't any that we found in our mapping scenarios that intersected any inundated areas. So that was great. Water systems. So the adaptive capacity with these included whether these structures, what depth they were at. This is looking at group A and group B systems. This is not looking at private wells because those are not mapped with that we, and nobody has them mapped that we've, of all the assessments that Alex and I have done, we haven't yet to find a countywide project that has, that we've been able to look at private wells. So, yes, sir.
For those of us not in your industry, can you explain group A and group B types of water systems?
Yes, you bet. And I don't know why that only, oh, yes, I do know why it says only group B. Group A systems and group B systems, and Alex, correct me if on this where I'm, if I mess this up, but these are well systems that are regulated by Department of Ecology. They're usually have multiple hookups. Then it's based on size, so the number of potential hookups for Group A and Group B, and they have different different management structures behind them as well. That's
right, yeah. Yeah. They regulate. So yeah, Washington Department of Health regulates them, and Group B is.
Health, yeah.
Let me see. Hold on. It is. Group B serves fewer than 15 connections or fewer than 25 people per day. And then I believe Group A is more than that, but I don't have the exact number for you.
Right. And a Group A could have a limited number. There could be a Group A with only 3 connections. So it could be expanded to 40, but it's only got 3 now. So, but there were no Group A's that were exposed to all the systems, and there aren't very many, were the Group B's with a few hookups.
At some point in here, do you refer to, I just built a spec house in Shine, so that's Port Ludlow, Jefferson County. Soon after we were almost complete in construction, there's now a moratorium on hookups because one of the 3 wells was seawater contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Do these kinds of events raise seawater level in an aquifer and create that risk? Is that what could have happened, or?
I wonder, I can't remember if we've got that graphic in here, but it's in the report. It can. It's very locally specific to your to the subsurface geology and what lies in between where how deep your well is and what aquifer it's drawing, and if there is a hard pan in between, an impervious surface in between it and the ocean surface. But it can in those shallower aquifers as the seas rise and it pushes the salt water wedge kind of subsurface, pushes it in a little bit, and then the groundwater comes up on top of it because groundwater will sit on top of the denser salt water. And we'll get groundwater flooding as well as saltwater intrusion into those wells. So it depends on how deep the wells are. And it's something that we did not have a hydrogeologist on this project. It was out of scope of this project, but that is something that, yeah, should be looked at. And a lot of places like Island County, I know they've got some saltwater intrusion risk areas, so they know generally where their aquifer, the drinking water aquifers are being pulled from that might be shallower and they should be looked at. It did come up with agricultural properties here in that That was the concern for them, and so one of the recommendations, spoiling your thunder a little bit, Alex, but is to watch those agricultural wells for chlorides a little bit. And they believe that the conservation district's already working with the farming community to look at that. So monitoring wells for chlorides and individual wells as well is a good strategy, yeah, for sure.
So at a second grade layman's term, yes.
It can.
Seawater rise can potentially create a larger risk for freshwater well infiltration.
It can, yes.
Did you say that the county didn't have a comprehensive
Private wells.
Yeah.
All those straws in the ground.
So what is the, I mean, there's just nothing to do to plan around that.
I don't know. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I think that's one of the recommendations from this report is to maybe follow up on that and maybe do a study. I know that Department of Ecology is currently mapping those. So that should be some information that we'll have soon.
Is it ecology or is it health? I keep mixing those up. Yeah, Alex got us straight. That can be really hard because a lot of people, they think they know where their wells are. It's kind of like they think they know where their septics are. And also the depth and the condition of the wells, that matters a lot. So your well is susceptible, your private wells are susceptible to and are low adaptive capacity if they don't have good surface seals, because all the private wells have a surface component to it, right? And so if that is not capped and sealed, then if you have overwash of salt water, you can get salt water down there, even if you have a nice deep well. So if it's made with really old BMPs, best management practices, or old
construction materials.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, if it's not cased correctly and you can get some interstitial kind of the surface water kind of getting into it that way. So those are concerns. And one of the things we thought of to address that, because we don't have all the data for that, we recommend to create like a self-assessment for that landowners or property owners, can look at and go through a checklist. And then if they've got the data, then they can go and say, okay, this might be a risk. I should go talk to Department of Health and get an inspection. Oh, maybe I might want to look at chlorides. Maybe I should, take advantage of the water quality testing through the Department of Health and the county's health department and watch my chlorides or something. So there's a few things like that Alex and I had brainstorms on and that might be able to help residents that we couldn't help them with in this report. Yeah.
Do you guys have this mapped somewhere too, like susceptible areas of water systems?
Oh, the saltwater intrusion hazard areas.
Yeah.
I don't know if that we didn't have that. I wonder, and it's different from the critical area recharge, critical aquifer recharge areas, CARAs, that are in the CAO. That's a little bit different too. Although that does, a CARA, if there's a CARA within a saltwater inundation area, then that's, you could think of a surface contamination, but. And I'm stretching. I'm an ecologist. I'm not a hydrogeologist, so I'm going to probably have to stop there before I say something incorrect.
It's part of our comprehensive plan review. We did consider in the critical areas ordinance update, we did consider saltwater intrusion areas, but nothing was formally adopted this time because of the same reason. There wasn't really enough data. It is my understanding that we didn't have enough information to really say, here's where the line needs to be and what you have to look for.
Yeah, it's not just the location when it comes to this infrastructure. It's the quality of it, the nature of it, and its construction, and that's really hard to get from a countywide data set. So not impossible, but it's just not there yet. Yeah. Stormwater facilities. Here we go. Okay, so stormwater and sea level rise, it gets complicated because the stormwater drains through gravity usually, although I did see pumps in Seebeck, but really wants gravity to get out and to low tide environments. So the more the less time you have at low tide, because your sea levels are just generally a little bit higher, or you have more frequent storms, the less your land drains with the stormwater. High tides then can push back on coastal outlets or outfalls and create that backwater pressure, which can flood you up behind. So that's why we look at the stormwater facilities and recommend that it be, I think it might still be too, or already be, as part of the maintenance considerations with stormwater, is cleaning ditches so that the culverts don't get blocked and drained, so the channels of the ditches have, and stormwater ponds and rain gardens have more volume that they can hold and then either infiltrate or outfall. So there might be some areas that you need to have bigger areas to contain water and then pump out. But I believe that Public Works probably already knows about all of these areas, having looked at seeing what I saw in Silverdale in the park there.
And they were on our technical advisory committee as well.
Yeah. The stormwater and rain gardens. This is the Grover's Creek Hatchery. So there is some potential impact in there as far as drainage. And then here you would have the river, Grover's Creek, trying to get out. And if it's at high tide more frequently, it's going to be higher. It's going to be back pressured a little bit, just like a stormwater system would. Creeks also face this. So, and that could lead to a little bit of flooding there. Now, whether the hatcheries got electricals down in the way, or if they're in a building that's farther back on, towards the parking lot, then they're going to be fine. So they're used to getting wet on occasion. So that's something for them to be aware of, these kinds of structures. The Gorse Hatchery was far enough back that it didn't seem to be impacted. Sewer facilities. The top says, what, 6 sewer facilities. Okay, and these are, when we say sewer facilities, we're not talking wastewater treatment plants. Those all seemed to be fine. This is these are the surface components to those things. And so we weren't sure if those were built to withstand some temporary inundation. So, but we do know that when things go bad with sewer infrastructure, it goes very bad for residents that are depending on it. So we classified it it's a medium. I don't know why it's red there, but it should be an orange box. But it's still highly vulnerable because of those areas I'm trying to remember what's the name of those structures. I'm just having an end of the day brain fart, Alex, with the structures that are, if you have it in front of you.
The cleanouts or the facilities? Is that what you're asking me?
I think it was the cleanouts. It was just like, pardon? No, it wasn't the outfalls. It was like cleanouts. It was structures that are up, and it wasn't lift stations. They had an interesting name that Yeah, sorry.
I can find it for you. Force mains, gravity mains.
No, those are the long. That's the long drainage structures.
And those wet wells.
Wet wells. Thank you.
There you go. Yeah,
that's wet wells. Yep. So. Those ones, there's some of those that are in the inundation areas. Whether they are susceptible to saltwater brushing over them during storms, I'm not sure. That would be for the county department that watches them. There we go. I should have just gone on. So all in all, it's pretty good. Now the gravity mains and force mains, that's a lot of miles. Feet. I don't know where. Yeah, okay. I was looking at the 22,000 number there, and I was like, "What the what?" 22,000 feet of force mains. But again, these are built to be wet. They're usually subsurface anyway. They're used to flooding, so it just would mean that we've got them mapped. But if they're in an area that could be eroded, or in an area with a infrastructure failure on the top, you don't really cross any bridges with them, so they're kind of low risk, low vulnerability. Okay, moving on. Some maps of where these are. Yeah, that's the one treatment plant. This is down in Manchester. It's pretty close to the little estuary, the tip of the estuary there. But again, that represents an extreme flood. So it's probably fine for the next 20, 30 years. But if it needs to be rebuilt, maybe it needs to, you know, maybe consider building it in such a way that it would be more resilient to temporary inundation. Oh, here we go, wastewater and on-site septics. This is what we just discussed this. We'll keep going. Wetlands, we were asked to look at wetlands. And this is, we did not look at these as far as the coastal squeeze goes. So we did not look to see where these wetlands ran up against armored shorelines or structures that would prevent them from moving inland. We took a quick look at that, but we didn't survey that with the highest degree of, I don't know what the word there I was going to look for. But anyway, so there are some areas that are likely to go from right now fresh tolerant or salt tolerant to salt obligate. So, but again, I think we know where most of those areas in Dokeg Watts is most of it.
We have Planning Commissioner Vliet online with a question.
Yes, thank you so much for this presentation. I had a question with regard to wetlands and the coastal, the ones right on the water, I guess. For instance, there's like something I've seen, the Finn Creek Estuary Restoration up in Hansville. And I was just wondering, with projects like that, I know they're trying to better the environment for salmon restoration, but does that have any positive, negative effect, or indifferent with regards to protections to the homes in the area with those projects, or does it just kind of depend? Thank you.
Yeah, and I don't know if Blue Coast was actually involved in that one, but I could tell you, so my job for almost 10 years at Island County was salmon restoration work. We were also doing that while Island County was part of the Washington Coast Resiliency Project, and project which was part of that was also looking at restoration and how to do restoration for habitat in the light of sea level rise. And all of that to be said, when it's funded with grant money, grant money will not do anything that puts homes at risk. It just doesn't get through the grant funding review process. So restoration projects, when they're done for fish or coastal inundation and habitat processes, we look for the multi-benefit projects. And shore-friendly, you've got a great shore-friendly team here. They're amazing, and they can help. And also the Whisper, the lead entity in Kitsap County, also has a bunch of information on this. And you're also really adjacent in the Hood Canal Coast is the Hood Canal Coordinating Council, also looks at multi-benefit projects with to restore habitat. So those projects usually are looking to help soften shorelines, which would absorb wave energy that would otherwise eat away at coastal hard coastlines, or refract down the beach and damage property. So the more you can soften that wave energy as it comes into a natural beach, the better. A lot of times those places are opening things back up for storage as well, for flood storage. So, and groundwater relief too, as groundwater comes up, if sea levels are going in underneath the freshwater and pulling them up, that gives them a better way to get out. The water gets out during low tides rather than being embayed behind some kind of hard structure. So they aim to produce functioning areas that will absorb some of the negativity that sea level rise can bring, while also providing habitat for the species that we care about and that the sound depends on. So those are the goals. And I do not know of a grant program that would fund any kind of design that would not do that, that would put homes at risk. People always come before any of the animals. It doesn't feel like it sometimes, but having been on those grant review processes, I can tell you for a fact that's the case. Does that answer?
I was just going to say, we did hear about a similar sentiment from the Technical Advisory Committee and also from county staff. So one of the recommendations that's included in the report is to consider revising an existing policy within the Shoreline Master Program to require shoreline ecosystem protection and restoration projects to consider the implications of sea level rise, and also to encourage early coordination with DEM or emergency response entities to ensure that public safety and residences in the area are preserved.
Speaking of beaches, so this came out of kind of two prongs. So where we got asked by the advisory committee, what about forage fish and beaches? And forage fish need that intertidal area in between the subtidal and the back shore area. So they need the ground, they need the gravels and the sand that get wet twice a day, and but that also dry out. And so as sea levels come up, if that beach doesn't have a way to migrate backwards and up, like if it goes into a wall or property or a bluff, then we lose the acreage for forage fish. We did not, this was like a late request, so we did not have the time to look at the layer of data, the data layer with armor, shoreline armor, and also most importantly, we don't know where the beaches are that, not just the ones that have been mapped by DFW that had fish, that have had forage fish occurrence at some point in the last 20 years, but where could they be? And that depends on the sand, the gravels and cobbles and the fish, the sand structure. So we don't have a map of where all of the potential spawning grounds are, so we couldn't do that assessment. Also, beach access was a big concern right from the get-go of what beach accesses were going to be impacted. And then that we covered in the marinas and bays, because it looked like a lot of the beach accesses are at the end of roads that go down and with easements, road easements that touch the ground or touch, pardon me, touch the water, boat ramps, stuff like that. So there's some, you know, they're just going to be wetter a little bit longer, but we didn't see anywhere that might be cut off that would reduce that. So don't, yeah, so we didn't really see a huge problem there with beach access becoming obscured. Seafood and shellfish industry facilities, this is, we are looking at the buildings that they're processed in, so not the shellfish habitat. So low risk of exposure, they're all up and high and back from the water. Low adaptive capacity, though, because they're usually shore dependent, so you can't move them too far inland. They need to be near the shore. Parks, this was an interesting exercise. So there's a little bit of judgment call here, because parks we looked at as a parcel. So if they're like, so like Kitsap Community Park, Kitsap Park, it's up on the way to Hood Canal, the bridge on the west side, it's on, right on Hood Canal. It's okay. I'll look at it here. Kitsap Memorial State Park. There we go. So Kitsap Memorial State Park, it's in the yellow box. When we first ran this data, all of these popped red because they all have an edge on the coast. So the whole parcel went red. When we looked at each of them, Kitsap Memorial State Park has the bluff and the stairs that go down. The historic buildings are up on the top of the bluff, and they're fine. So we realized that we had to make a bit of a judgment call with the exposure. So that's why this rule set for parks is a little different. So if the majority of the park is low and it looks like it could be inundated, then it was classified as being highly exposed. If it was just touching the beach but went upland and the majority of the park and the park surface where people hang out and love, then it was low if the majority of it was fine. So that's how we did parks. And I think the map is here, and the maps for them to show you kind of where they're at. So Salisbury Point Park there is up there. Point No Point is no surprise. Yeah, and then the one that's right by Kingston, that's kind of low as well, and so that one has got some inundation concerns. The small park that's just northeast of the bridge, south of Kingston there. And then Key Point County Park has got some water. The one in Silverdale where the pumps are, and then down in Anderson Point. But the rest are good so far under our mapping scenario. Okay, I think we're just about done, I believe. Oh, so this was just illustrating what I was saying. So those colorful little polygons on the side, just with the mapping exercise, if it intersects one of those, it pops up. So mapping nuances. Agricultural land, we've talked about that as well. There weren't very many. This was based on the windshield survey that the conservation district did, and we got this data 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, kind of late, but we got it, so thank you to the conservation district. We intersected that with the inundation layers, but a lot of those areas, the number of parcels you'll see, like on the image on the left-hand side, the one big rectangular parcel is connected to one of the parcels across the road. It's the same parcel number, so we had all flagged as being at high exposure risk, but really the toe of it down is the only part of it, so the ag part of it is going to be fine. And then the other image is that one has maybe some concerns, but I didn't see, like, looking at the parcel, I think that's Dogfish Creek if I remember right. Maybe not. No. I couldn't tell if it was just really fancy lawn or if they actually used it for hay or if they had an orchard. So the windshield survey looked at any kind of ag production that could have bees, that could have sell eggs. So it wasn't just haying fields that they looked at. And I didn't see any of the big haying fields. When we talked to, that would be inundated. When the conservation district was on our TAC and they're the ones that told us that saltwater intrusion is an issue, and they're already watching their wells in areas like up in the top of Paul's Bow, north of Paul's Bow, and then down in Purdy. So not that they're seeing problems, but that's what they're watching. Brownfields and landfills. There wasn't a lot of these because a lot of the existing brownfields and landfills are in incorporated areas or maybe property, so, and those aren't part of this list. So Coast Guard up at the Point No Point. Oh, and I think it's the next one, the toxins, contaminants, yeah. So, and we also looked at the contaminants. All of the contaminants that are listed by Department of Ecology that are in these areas are already either have been handled or are being handled, except for the Point No Point, which is still underway or about to get underway, and I don't know what that means, but the rest of them are in good shape. And so it popped things like some businesses that had some flags. You know, there was one, like, it was a some kind of industrial business down in Gorst. I can't remember, it was a welding, I think it might have been a welder's shop, that kind of thing. So, but again, they've been mitigated. All right, and with that, we've gotten through all of the assets that we looked at. This is a much shorter section, you'll be happy to know. So before we go leave results, does anybody have any questions? Or... All right, Alex.
Thanks, Dawn. So the adaptation strategies that we're going to cover here are intended to be very high level and are described in further detail in the report in Section 5, but then also within Section 6, which describes recommended code amendments to address some of these adaptation strategies when you go to update your codes in the future. So some of those adaptation strategies include consider requiring assessments or reports to include sea level rise projections for impacted properties, reviewing development setbacks near geologically hazardous areas, limiting redevelopment or expansion of existing legal nonconforming structures in vulnerable areas, require special considerations when permitting critical infrastructure and facilities. Don talked about that a little bit earlier with the long-term planning horizon. The county could consider developing and implementing a repetitive loss program. You do have a channel migration zone planning level assessment. However, you could consider a more detailed mapping assessment of areas that are particularly vulnerable to better inform your planning decisions. You can consider the anticipated climate change impacts in the design of habitat restoration efforts. We covered that a little bit earlier. Next slide, please. Thank you. One thing that we did not evaluate in this report was impacts to commercial water-dependent industries. So the county could consider evaluating that further in the future. We could also consider incentivizing passive management strategies, encouraging alternatives to hard shoreline stabilization measures, provide support for educational opportunities about raising vulnerable structures, and identifying incentives or funding opportunities where available, like the BRIC grant, incentivizing community flood control and adaptation strategies. We discussed that as potentially community plans for vulnerable areas such as Hansville, prioritizing transportation connectivity and resiliency, particularly in areas that have single ingress and egress, evaluate existing stormwater infrastructure and conduct maintenance where needed to preserve that infrastructure over time. I just want to quickly pause here because some of those recommendations, the Department of Ecology put out the draft rulemaking actually yesterday. For jurisdictions, and that rulemaking is expected to be adopted in summer of 2026 is what the timeline that we've been told. So Don described this briefly earlier, but this requires jurisdictions to incorporate sea level rise planning within their shoreline master programs. And while the document that we provided you under this project is a planning level assessment that does not impact your development regulations or development within the Shoreline Master Program. The proposed rulemaking does require jurisdictions to conduct or utilize an existing sea level rise assessment that maps daily high tides for 2100 at a 50% certainty. This assessment should meet that requirement. However, that SMA rulemaking proposed change also includes designating a sea level rise hazard area, which would be a designated regulatory overlay, which would manage development within vulnerable areas. So that's just something to consider that's not included in this PowerPoint because we didn't know about it. But I just wanted to include that as a recommended next step before we start talking about the other ones that are included in the report.
Yeah. Yeah. Awkward timing.
Yeah. And we made that note in the report, and we probably will go through and make sure that all of the recommendations that we provided are in alignment with the proposed recommended code changes that are included in Section 6. So we will take a stab at doing that, but still we'll leave the disclaimer language that it is a draft rulemaking that is subject to change.
Yes, sir.
The very first adaptive strategy you outlined was something we touched on when we were looking at our critical areas ordinance. Mm-hmm. And the requirement for a report, again, you've got someone with a medium high bluff. You've got to have a geohydrologist report. We've got to have a habitat management report. What does a sea level projection report look like? Who do I hire and what does that cost?
That's a great question. So hopefully I think the sea level rise hazard area would define what that would look like, and then you would be subject to additional regulations. That said, we just saw the draft rulemaking yesterday. So again, that's subject to change, but that's, I believe, the intent of the SMP is that you would then be subject to additional regulations versus providing an additional report.
And we don't know who. Is there a consultant field at this point that is the climate change group that was, this is the people I have to hire?
Yeah, well,
I think
I think what we're hoping is that you don't need to do that, is that
we're hoping, then again, it'll matter where the rulemaking ends up, that once you could define a hazard area and you could use some of the mapping that we've produced for you, so you already have it, could call this a hazard, you know, this is the sea level rise hazard area. And if your property project, if your project falls within this hazard area, then you are going to be required to do this. And it'll be interesting to see how many new areas are picked up. I don't know that there's going to be a lot of new areas that get picked up because of the geologically hazardous areas in your CAO with the bluffs, those are already covered. Mm-hmm. And we don't really have great sea level rise to be information about how fast that's going to increase any kind of sloughing or erosion, ridge recession is going to be. So I would imagine you just kind of take that into account, add the words in the report as your into your regs as your justification. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
So the recommendation for a report is some kind of report by somebody who knows something about climate change.
Well, it might not be an extra report that is needed for a permit, for a development requirement, a development request, permit request.
I see your question now. I apologize. I thought you were talking about the development within the hazard area, but I see that you're asking the question about the first bullet point. For the report to include sea level rise projections, that would be like in a geotechnical report for like analyzing rates of erosion and things like that and impacts from coastal hazards.
So yeah,
for development within of the hazard area. I apologize. I misunderstood the question.
Yeah. It's kind of like with the restoration, restoration projects are required to consider sea level rise and climate change impacts to protect the public investment that's being paid into those restoration. You don't need to hire anybody new or special in that. You just have to incorporate that work if it's well interpreted. And a lot of the times, you know, it's the university and it's Sea Grant, Washington Sea Grant, that's doing that work, and their services are offered, you know, usually. So, yeah.
And these requirements under the SMA rulemaking would not be applicable to Kitsap County until you conduct your next periodic update, which I believe you're on the cycle for 2029, but Jim can correct me if I'm wrong on that. 2028 or 2029?
Are you 2027? Oh, good.
Okay. All right. That was right the first time. So some of the recommended next steps would be to expand on the findings of this report and begin implementing resiliency strategies, seek grant opportunities for financial support to replace aging infrastructure, particularly in areas or assets that we've identified as vulnerable. We talked about that a gap earlier was quantifying the exposure of forage fish beaches where coastal squeeze could be experienced. You could consider the revisions to plans or development regulations that are included in Section 6. So beyond the Shoreline Master Program, there's also recommendations in there to the Critical Areas Ordinance and the Comprehensive Plan and the Hazard Mitigation Plan as well. You could identify areas where channel migration is a concern and then again apply a more detailed channel migration zone delineation to inform future hazards, integrated flood management and restoration efforts.
And that is an expertise that is hired. Yeah, that's a fluvial geomorphologist that does those.
We discussed with the Hansville community during a public meeting that it may be beneficial for a community plan to be developed to more broadly implement resiliency strategies across the shoreline. A future study could be conducted to identify areas that are most at risk of saltwater intrusion. We discussed that this evening as well, that you could identify saltwater intrusion risk areas to evaluate future development within those areas. You could contact system managers of Group B water systems that are identified as vulnerable to increase awareness of potential exposure hazards. Our team is actually trying to conduct this for you, but hopefully we'll be able to develop an informational tool that allows residents to conduct a high-level self-assessment for assets that we didn't have information for, like individual on-site septic systems or wells, to help inform their own level of exposure. That could also be linked to the county's ArcGIS story map, or we also have a web map where you can scroll into the individual parcels to see what assets are present and then what the different levels of exposure are. We also had multiple meetings with the Department of Ecology about some potential roadblocks to better implementing resiliency strategies. So one of our recommendations is to work with Department of Ecology to identify ways to streamline permitting for certain resiliency strategies, like raising a structure and update codes to allow for that improved implementation. And then Don touched on this earlier. We do have an ArcGIS story map that's available on the county's dedicated sea level rise website. In addition to that, we also have the web map that I just briefly described as well, where you can zoom in on these projections to better understand the actual impacts versus the individual maps that are included in the report.
Yeah, and the story map is being updated right now. The active link goes to the one that we put up at the beginning and midway through the project. So the final one that I've got about 80% done on the back end is got the web map linked in it. And then it touches a little bit on the different results, but directs people mostly back to the report or the web map if they want to look in it. So they're not scrolling and scrolling and scrolling through the story map. And there's some more pictures and some graphics in there as well to kind of explain the salt water, you know, how the salt water moves underground water and coastal impacts that way.
Yeah, I would say that there's a lot more information on our website. And also that interactive mapping tool, you can get on there and scroll around the county you can select your sea level rise preferences and see what it looks like on your own. And there's also a link on there to drop comments to me directly. So make sure that it's still open for comments from the public and you as well. And we're taking this to the board next week. And then we're going to wrap this up by the end of the month. So. If you do have comments or suggestions, please get them in soon. Thank you.
Yeah. I think, and if I had to represent what we heard from the public, from our outreach, roads and road access during flood extreme storms is the one that we heard the most repeatedly about. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome.
I think that's it for us, unless you have additional questions.
Is there a comment matrix included in the final report?
No, but we do have comments summarized. They're in Word documents, not necessarily a matrix.
I would think that having the public comments as part of the report might be important.
Yep.
It is.
Yeah. We can put that in the matrix. It's not a problem.
Yep. Not to mention tectonics. We have a geologist in the group.
You do? Or do we?
2 weeks ago, they came out with a major study on coastal Washington, coastal Oregon, about sea level drop up to 2 meters as a result of the major earthquakes. Did you look at how that would impact this county?
No, we did because that data does not yet exist with a lot of resolution and which I'm looking for. We did reach out to the people that I believe did that study. This was a year and a half ago, when we first started this project. And we reached out to the University of Washington, and they were the ones trying to model what the projected drop in land elevation would be during a Cascadia subduction event. And that is
They have published.
Yeah, but they think that you said they just did it like 2 weeks ago,
yes.
Right? And was it for Kitsap County?
No.
That's the problem,
coastal.
Yeah.
And I was just saying, since the big report came out in Coastal, it would be nice if you made some sort of comment of how that affects Kitsap County.
We don't know, though. That's the problem, is I don't think that we know how it would impact here, because they haven't modeled it in within Puget Sound.
Yeah. And not to mention where we are right now, the major concern is the Seattle Fault.
Yeah, we don't know what that drop is going to be that I know of.
But that's in, we also work in Pacific County in Ilocos, so this does come up with them. And that's what we have to say straight off, is that this is for the projected sea level rise. This does not involve, this does not account for what would happen with a big subduction event or a big tectonic event, or like you say, with the fault here. That just puts everything kind of in a different realm.
They measured the wave height at the engorst of 6 feet.
Did they? Yeah. For this
last Seattle fault.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it's one of those things that's kind of, I mean, I guess what the county could do. That's one that's really, my brain just went in like four different directions. So one of the things we're talking about, like with the Handsbell group, possibly a community plan, would be involve emergency management, like in helping them be resilient in the case of emergency. What happens if they do get cut off by their roads being broken or inundated and their houses surrounded by water for 3 days? How can you be resilient? What do you need to have on hand? What should you be looking at? How can you proof your house up to then, before that? And it doesn't make you bulletproof of any of that. But maybe that also would help during a subduction or during an earthquake, where all of a sudden things go crazy and resources are hard to come by, or emergency response is hard to come. Well, you've got the Navy. That's pretty helpful. They should have some help. That's what I know Island County relies on, because a lot of the attention is going to be at the big urban centers. And, those of us in the sub-rural, sort of rural communities might be lower down on the help totem pole. Again, I'm an ecologist. I'm speaking way outside my realm now, so I should probably be quiet. But we did not look at earthquake and what could happen and how far the land could drop or rise for that, because that doesn't, yeah. One tool that is coming for here that we talk about in the report but we didn't mention tonight is called COSMOS, and that is coastal storm modeling, and they use wind wave run up to look at some projections, but they also have a groundwater, it's called HERA tool, H-E-R-A, part of that COSMOS tool set. And they have done Whatcom County fully. They're doing the Puget Sound next. I think it was supposed to come online at the end of 2025, and then for the coast in 2026. But it's USGS, so we don't know where it is now. But that tool would be useful to look at in the future, too, for groundwater purposes.
Do we have any further comments, questions from the commission? David?
Not here.
I thought I saw your hand up. Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your patience. I know it's a lot and long and sort of dry, so I appreciate your patience and your attention. So, and thank you for allowing us to do this work with you, as you've got a wonderful technical expertise in your community. They were really great to work with, so yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you all.
Is Scott here? Are you ready to do an hour presentation?
I'm actually not doing the presentation.
I'm just wondering, since we're thinking about canceling the July meeting for lack of things to do, would this be something that we could do in July rather than spend the next hour?
Well, I guess that's up to the Planning Commission. We had already talked about canceling the July 1st for lack of business doing this tonight.
That's what I'm saying. We could move this to July.
Are you saying you don't want to do the training tonight?
I'm asking.
whatever you wish. Yeah, we can work on that.
Sorry, point of order. You said you're not doing the presentation. Is it someone else who's here?
No, this is a presentation that's done virtually.
It's done virtually. Thank you.
An hour later.
I'm actually okay either way.
Let's go.
Yeah, we published an agenda for this as well.
We're ready. Tonight.
Okay. So the training that we're going to get underway is called Jurassic Parliament. It's training that I've taken, general parliamentary training in the past. This training is more specific to planning commissioners than the council training or other trainings that they offer. It's a unique training in that it uses toy dinosaurs as part of its training technique, but it also is somewhat engaging, and we found that it offers a price point that gets a good message across in terms of parliamentary procedures at a really good price point. And so that's why I think this particular training is used by a lot of different jurisdictions. And so with that, is there anything else? Okay.
Yeah, and I will add, we can pause the video if you do have questions, or you can have those at the end of the video as well. Are we good to proceed with the video? Okay. Wonderful. Yes, I will. Sorry, I'm trying to get the sound working on it. Just a moment.
Parliament.com, where we show you how to master meetings using Robert's Rules. Welcome to our workshop. Today we're delighted to bring you great Planning Commission meetings. These are the topics that we're going to cover today. There are quite a few, but we'll keep it lively and I hope race through them. So first off, why are we here? What's the point? We want to invigorate staff to support and volunteers to run effective citizen advisory committee meetings to serve your community. We'll be modeling a planning commission, however, the material applies to all citizen advisory committees. After taking this training, you'll be able to apply the authority of the chair and members for more efficient meetings, use four fundamental guidelines for fair discussion, make motions and amendments, respond to disorder or difficult people, list 9 different planning commission pitfalls, and make better decisions for your community. What kind of problems does one encounter when serving on a planning commission? Well, we've identified some, and you can see if any of them resonate with you. One is when the commission members are not experienced in the world of meetings and fumble over process. Another problem is when the chair is a take-charge kind of guy or gal who dominates the meetings, riding roughshod over the members. You can also have a situation where the chair is weak and members of the commission take the bit between their teeth and they dominate the meetings. And finally, sometimes, alas, outside the meetings, commissioners slam their fellow commissioners on social media and in the press. So we're going to tackle these as we go through our session today. I want to quickly say that the material contained in this presentation is based on the principles and practices of parliamentary procedure. I'm not an attorney, and nothing in this presentation constitutes legal advice. If your attorney tells you something different, listen to your attorney. Our workshop method today is this. We are in the League of Northwest Dino Cities. It's not entirely realistic. It's a fantasy, but there's some overlap with real life, and you are going to be the members of the Bonnie Dino Planning Commission. So here's a map of the League. My late husband and I had a lot of fun creating the 70 cities, each of which has its own project. When it's time, you start the meeting by calling the meeting to order. You sit in the chair that's reserved for the person running the meeting. Chair, in this instance, has two meanings. It means the physical object on which you sit, and it means you as the chair. This goes back to ancient times when only the prince or potentate or bishop had a chair. Everybody else had to sit on the floor or stand or sit on stools. So it means the two things, you and the physical object. You wrap the gavel lightly one time, if you have one, and announce this meeting of the Bonnie Dino Planning Commission is called to order. You ask the clerk to take the roll, and you announce that a quorum is present, or not. It's the chair's duty to announce the quorum. The quorum is the minimum number of voting members who must be present for business to be done. And for local governments, usually it's a majority, more than half, of the fixed positions in the body, but it also could be a majority of the currently appointed members. So you have to find out what your quorum is. If you lose your quorum, you can't do business. The quorum is what allows you to take action, and for local government bodies, action includes listening or talking or speaking. So don't have a quorum that says 50% plus one. You can't have a fraction of a person. It's important for local government bodies not to create a walking quorum or a serial meeting. When members of the body talk or email with each other outside of meetings, such that a quorum is discussing the body's business, the Open Public Meetings Act has been violated. You can talk to other people as long as the number, the total number involved, is less than a quorum. And note that in Washington State, breaking this law carries a fine of $500 for the first violation and $1,000 for each violation thereafter. So it's a serious matter. There's an article by MRSC, the Municipal Research and Services Center. It's a low private nonprofit organization in Washington State that provides guidance for local government bodies. Who puts items on the agenda? The leadership prepares the draft agenda, usually the chair and the staff. They take into account the overall workflow and priorities approved by the organization, by the commission. You want to cultivate a thoughtful process, and if you as a commissioner have requests, they should be submitted well in advance. The draft agenda is prepared by the leadership, but under Robert's rules, it's under the control of the body, subject to notice requirements, of course. Robert's rule says that if you follow the standard order of business, you don't need to vote to adopt an agenda, but many bodies do vote. It takes a majority vote to adopt and a two-thirds vote to change it later in the meeting. Here's an example of a simplified standard order of business. Approval of minutes, officers' remarks and reports, committee reports, unfinished business, we don't use the term old business anymore, and then new business if your commission includes this. So we suggest that you prepare an agenda and add suggested times for each item, 10 minutes, 15, 20. You want to put all times approximate so that you're not hidebound by those times, but at least they give you guidance for how long is expected. And then stick to your agenda. Don't allow discussion to slide off into side topics not immediately relevant to the discussion. It's also helpful to identify whether items are for information, for discussion, or for decision. And we recommend not using the word action since that can be too broad. You want to watch the time. The chair's role is critical in keeping everything moving. It's not easy to do this, but you have to. You can use an agenda stand where you set it up by the side, or you can ask someone else to keep time. And here's a little paper that I'll send you. Time limits create productive meetings. Discussing time limits. So commissioners must read their packets in advance. I know sometimes it's a burden. Those packets can be big, but It's also very helpful to ask questions of the staff in advance and don't blindside them at the meeting. And if you have materials you want considered, send those in advance as well. Just a word on minutes. According to Robert's rules, the purpose of minutes is to record the actions taken by the body. Minutes record what is done and not what is said. And Jurassic Parliament strongly recommends either action minutes, which give just the decisions taken, or summary minutes that include the main points made without attribution to individuals. And this is far better than writing down everyone's remarks, ideas, and opinions. That will get you into a lot of trouble. Detailed minutes are a bad idea because it violates the fundamental purpose of minutes. It can create liability for the organization or individuals in case of a lawsuit. This has happened. It tends to personalize and politicize the discussion. It can intimidate participants, preventing them from speaking freely. It absorbs too much staff time and takes the group's time. And it makes it harder in the end to find the actions taken. Now, if you want more information on that, we have our workshop, live Zoom workshop, and online course about meeting minutes. I just want to note that there's a difference between a public hearing and public comment. A public hearing is an administrative procedure governed by state law and your council rules. It's a meeting of the public, and you must include testimony or a summary in the minutes. That's different from the public comment period. That's an agenda item governed by your own rules. And Jurassic Parliament recommends that details of public comment should not be included in the minutes. We have a blog entry on that, and MRSC recommends also that you don't include details, or if you want to, that you recommend a summary that avoids providing personally identifiable information on individual commenters. So there's a blog entry by MRSC that gives that information. And I will send you our guidelines for meeting minutes in local government, a brief summary on these points. So let's talk about meeting discussion, point of order, and appeal. There is a principle of Robert's Rules, very easy to say, all members have equal rights, privileges, and obligations. What could be simpler? Not so easy to carry it out in practice. And so it leads to a key point that discussion in commission meetings is not a conversation. It's debate and it has its own rules. And there is a fundamental guideline here. No one may speak a second time until everyone who wishes to do so has spoken once. Oh, it's so important. I'm going to give it to you in red. No one may speak a second time until everyone who wishes to do so has spoken once. Now, this is a common sense kind of rule, but for some reason, we don't follow it. Commissions and committees tend to discuss their affairs in conversational mode. In conversations, dominant people tend to dominate, and agreeable people tend to let them. So you must have a structure to make sure that everyone has an equal chance to speak. And this is both fair and efficient. It's also the best way to ensure that each person has an equal voice. Robert's Rules gets a bad rap, you know, out of date, 19th century, anachronistic. But in fact, the formality of this creates inclusion. This will make for robust discussion and it will advance your equity goals. So we strongly recommend. Now, note that this guideline pertains to discussion on the substantive issues. The chair will speak more than others on procedural matters because they have the role of facilitating the discussion during the meeting. Now, suppose that this is not happening, and suppose that your meeting is like a hockey match. The chair should stop. But if the chair fails to do so, then a member can make a point of order. So point of order is a motion, and when another member breaks one of the rules, a member may make a point of order and the chair rules on the point. So we represent it in Jurassic Parliament by a flying dinosaur. So here's our main motion, which is represented by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. We're discussing something important, and then somebody makes an insulting comment. So a member makes a point of order. It flies over the head of the other dinosaur, and the chair bats it out of the sky. So I'm going to play you an example of a point of order.
Point of order.
State your point.
That comment breaks our rules of decorum.
The point is well taken. Members may not use this term.
So you see, it's very simple. It's a motion claiming that a procedural mistake has been made. According to Robert's rules, it can only be made by a member of the body, but we recommend that the key staff be authorized also. So the public may not make a point of order. If you have somebody standing up in your audience and saying point of order, they are out of order. So you say point of order, the chair replies, state your point, you explain, and then the chair issues a ruling. You can make this at any time except during voting. You don't have to be recognized. You can actually speak right up, and you even may interrupt a speaker if necessary. We recommend not doing this often. This is going to make you unpopular, but you can. The key thing to know is it must be timely. You have to make the point of order at the time of the offense. If you wait a day or an hour, it's going to be too late. So again, here's a little slide showing us how to process it. We recommend using the third person to keep things neutral and lessen conflict. The chair is stating the general rule. Don't say you're out of order or you made a mistake, because that creates personal emotional conflict. And when in doubt, ask the group. The chair can always ask the group to decide if a point of order is correct, if it's well taken, or not. So let's have an example of that. That statement is just a bunch of baloney. Point of order, state your point. The word baloney is insulting. The chair is in doubt and will ask the group to decide. All those who believe that the word baloney is insulting, please say aye. All those who believe it is not insulting, please say no. The ayes have it, the word baloney is insulting and may not be used. Or the noes have it, the word baloney is not insulting and may be used. So Harry S. Truman famously said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. This is a wonderful way for you to get out of the kitchen and let the group take the heat. Now, the chair does not have to say point of order, because the chair already has the duty of maintaining order and decorum. The chair just needs to take appropriate action, which we'll be talking about later. And the chair is subject to the same rules. So if the chair breaks one of the rules, a member may raise a point of order, and the chair rules on their own behavior, which seems odd, but is the way the system works. Once the chair has ruled on a point of order, the only allowable form of discussion is to appeal the ruling. An appeal, in our view, is the most important motion in all of Robert's rules and the least known. So the chair enforces order and decorum. The group is the final authority. Any two members can appeal a ruling of the chair. One member appeals and one seconds. Now, there is an exception. If the ruling is a matter on which there cannot be two reasonable interpretations, the ruling cannot be appealed. So here's how it goes. Chair, point of order. State your point. My esteemed colleague has used the term cream-faced loon in referring to the secretary. According to Robert's rules, insults are not allowed in debate. The point is well taken. Members will refrain from using improper language. Chair, I appeal the point of order on the grounds that cream-faced loon is a literary reference and not an insult. Second, very well, since the ruling of the chair has been appealed, the group will decide. Note that appeals pertaining to proper use of language and decorum may not be debated. Isn't that a good rule? If we could debate whether cream-faced loon is insulting, we'd be there all night. All those who believe that cream-faced loon is an insult say aye. All those who believe this phrase is not an insult say no. The ayes have it, the ruling of the chair is sustained, and members may not use this term, or emotionally as if it should be the other way around, as if we should be voting on whether the person making the appeal is correct. But that's not it. We vote on whether the chair's ruling is sustained. So point of order is made by one member, but an appeal needs a second. Point of order and appeal are processed immediately. No other business can take place until they are dealt with. And points of order and appeals don't count against a member's turn to speak in debate. We believe in Jurassic Parliament that point of order and appeal are the heart of democracy. They are the tools whereby the group is the final authority and the chair cannot simply run away with the meeting. So we recommend them to you strongly. We're not going to have points of information about members of the audience because, as we'll discuss later, they're in a different category than you all in the council. And there's no such thing as a point of clarification. If you want to explain about something, that is debate, and it doesn't fall under the rubric of point of order or point of information. I believe the town attorney could call a point of order, and it's not just the chair, it's the members of the body who can call a point of order, because the attorney has the duty of making sure that the council is following legal procedure and acting correctly. And let's move on and look at how to do this. So we have five recommendations for you, which we're going to go through here. And the first is to seek recognition. The chair controls who speaks when. So if you want to speak, you raise your hand or wait to speak or until the chair calls your name, nods at you, or gives some other sign that you have permission to speak. And don't raise your hand and start to speak at the same time, which people sometimes tend to do. When you have not been recognized, you have a duty to remain silent. This is a shock to some people. The exception is a point of order when it's essential. So here's a wonderful paper, Rights and Responsibilities of the Member, written by a colleague that we'll be sending to you. So what all this means is we're not going to have crosstalk between commissioners. We're not going to have commissioners talking directly to each other. And a very useful phrase for the chair is, members will kindly seek recognition before speaking. Or, if that's too formal, you can just say, just a moment, Josh, Elaine has the floor. So how are you going to achieve this? Well, the chair can keep track of who has spoken and who wishes to speak using a chart. The chair can empower the vice chair to do this. It's good training for them. Here's a sample of a speaking chart. And you are perfectly free to adapt this for your own purposes. I use it when I run Corral board meetings, and I just check off each person as they speak. Then I know who has spoken and who has not. A great method is the round robin, where the chair goes around the table asking each person in turn for their opinion. People may pass and speak at the end. Now, if you do that, you want to have a pencil in hand to jot down points or questions for when your turn arrives. And the chair has to wait their turn also. Sometimes chairs just start answering everybody back. So, and this also applies to questions and answers. We'll talk about that later in our staff discussion. We also have another method called the exploratory round robin that I'll send you in the packet. And this is where, on the first round, everybody agrees not to make motions, and instead, you have the staff note down on a whiteboard or a discussion sheet people's views as to the positives, the negatives, and questions they may have. You don't put down whose views they are. You just put down the key points, and if more than one person says something, you put a hash mark by it. And this is a wonderful way to see the full scope of the issue before you get into discussion. When a member has the floor, they have the right to speak until they've completed their comments. Members may not interrupt each other. The chair may interrupt members when it's necessary to bring them to order, and members may interrupt to make a point of order when it's essential. You don't want to have sidebars or texting. No whispering, no disable the chat. No texting to each other or people outside during meetings, and no posting on social media during meetings. Unless technical full considerations prevent it, all members should keep their camera on when participating online. Otherwise, you're lurking. You are observing your colleagues without yourself being observed, and this is disturbing and creates an unpleasant emotional imbalance. This is also ensures that you keep the quorum. So another fundamental guideline is that courtesy and respect are required. So you don't want to be intimidated by anger. Evolutionary psychologists tell us that anger evolved in the service of bargaining to resolve conflicts of interest in favor of the angry individual. And there are five kinds of remarks that are inappropriate. Personal remarks about other members, discourteous remarks, insulting language or attacks, inflammatory language, criticizing past actions of the group with two exceptions. If the subject is under discussion by the whole group, you can criticize it, or if the member is going to propose to amend or rescind the action at the end of their speech, then you can criticize it. And then the big umbrella, remarks that are not germane, that are not relevant to the discussion. So, again, I'll send you a paper on this, and here's a sample.
That's a flat, outright lie.
So Robert says the measure, what we're talking about, not the member, is the subject of debate. The moment the chair hears such words as fraud, liar, or lie used about a member in debate, he must act immediately and decisively to correct the member and prevent its repetition. So you can say something, you think something's wrong. I believe there is strong evidence that the member is mistaken. That's fine, but you just can't say a lie. What about the deer in the headlights problem? You hear something, you know it's off, but how do you quickly identify it and respond? Well, we have the wait cheat sheet, which is a laminated card that gives you what you can say in these different circumstances. And you will receive in your email tomorrow a coupon good for half off on the cost of this cheat sheet. Who decides, if any question arises, whether a remark is appropriate or not, or a comment is germane, the chair rules subject to appeal. And the chair may also ask to turn immediately to the group, as we saw. Ultimately, it's the group's call. Very important note, we're speaking here about discussion within commission and committee meetings. These prohibitions do not apply to the public when they're giving public comment. So I'm going to include in your packet these 50 guidelines for public comment. Now, it's essential to be in touch with your public, to be responsive, and to appear responsive. So given the limitations of the public comment period, we recommend maintaining other channels for dialogue with the public. Community forums, personal discussions, coffee with the commission, or a form on your website, whatever. So the chair controls who speaks when. The chair serves as a benevolent dictator, enforcing the rules that the group has chosen. Some people don't like that term, but I think it's accurate because it's in the service of the group, and individual members must seek recognition before speaking. So if someone speaks up without being recognized, you want to stop them. If someone speaks out of turn, you want to interrupt them. If someone makes insulting remarks, you cut them off. So it's really important for you in your service as a chair or a leader to know whether you have that capacity. Can you do that? Because if you don't, then you're at the risk of our third problem of dominant members taking the bit in their teeth and running away with stuff. This is a free cheat sheet that will be in your packet of language tips for meeting management, so it can help you out. Now, members have a duty to obey the chair's directions. If they disagree, they can't argue back. So what can they do? They can make a point of order or an appeal. If one member is struggling to understand the point made by another member, do they each have to wait their turn? Yes, they do, unless you're having a study session, in which is more conversational. Can the vice chair speak up if the chair isn't participating or responding during discussions to manage the meeting? Well, you can, although you hope that's not going to happen. And maybe you then want to have a meeting with the chair outside the meeting to talk about how the discussion should be done. Absolutely. Cut them off pertains to the members speaking. The members speaking. That is not in the case for public comment. Under the First Amendment, citizens can say basically whatever they want, and the body has to allow them to do so. There are a few exceptions, but in general, the rules for the commissioners, the members of the body, are very different from the rules for the public. Our next section is motions and amendments. A main motion is a proposal to do something. It starts the action, and it should be in writing, if at all possible. So we recommend this sequence. The staff presents the proposal in writing and answers any questions. Each member may ask one or two questions, then the next member has a turn. Public comment is taken, if that is your process. The motion is moved and seconded. The members discuss the motion and may amend it. That's when amendments come in. And then the members vote on the motion. In Jurassic Parliament, we use the T-Rex to stand for a main motion. A main motion should be clear and unambiguous. Don't say, I move what he just said, or so moved. Now, it should be phrased in the grammatical positive. Don't make a motion not to do something. It must comply with the bylaws and the procedural law of the land, and you can only have only one main motion at a time. This is another of the four main guidelines. If we're discussing allowing people to have patios in their private yards, and somebody makes another motion to raise the parking fees, this motion is out of order. Has to go away until we've dealt with the one in hand. So one thing at a time is another important guideline. To make a main motion at the right time, any member says, I move that, and states as clearly and concisely as possible what is proposed. The member has the responsibility of formulating the motion. Don't mix up your ideas about the subject with the motion itself. Save those for debate. So here's our main motion. I move that we recommend to council that residents be authorized to build patios in their private yard. If you are out driving and you come to an intersection, you don't have to stop and think, should I step on the brakes or step on the gas? You know just what to do because you've internalized the system. I would like to ask you to internalize the 8 steps to process a motion. The member makes the motion. Another member seconds it. The chair states the motion. People often forget to do that. The members debate and or amend the motion. The chair restates the motion and calls for the vote. The members vote on the motion. The chair states the results of the vote, whether the motion passes or fails, and what happens next as a result of the vote, and then the chair states the next item of business. So after a member makes the motion, another member seconds it. You second a motion to show that you would like to talk about it. There's no need to be recognized. It's okay to second a motion you disagree with if you want to explain why it's a bad idea. If there's no second, the chair says, there being no second, the motion will not be considered, and then moves immediately to the next item of business. So once the motion has been made, seconded, and stated, the chair says we'll have discussion on this motion. General contractor, as the maker of the motion, you have the right to speak first. Cats are a safe and effective way to protect cats from predators and birds from cats. Here is an example of a sweet little catio. I urge my colleagues to vote in favor of this motion. The photographer says, I'm in favor. My cousin has built a catio, and her little pet Fuzzy is completely at home in it. Then the architect says, I think this is a terrible idea. Catios are intrusive and will ruin the look of our city. Here's an example I saw when I visited Dino Dome last week. We don't want to have this in our city. So when it seems that discussion is finished, the chair says, is there any further discussion or are you ready to vote? And if no one speaks up, you take the vote. So these are kind of rhetorical questions. chair announces the next item of business. The ayes have it, the motion passes, and we will recommend to council that residents be authorized to build patios in their private yards, or the noes have it, the motion fails, and we will not recommend this proposal to council. So you want to check your requirements for a vote to pass, and on a voice vote, the chair must call for the negative vote, even if it seems obvious that the motion is unanimous. Robert's rule says that to abstain is to do nothing, and that the chair should not call for abstentions, but local government bodies generally will call for them, and that's fine. So under Robert's rules, to abstain is to do nothing. Abstentions are not counted. It could be that abstaining will affect the quorum. Now, we have, again, our fundamental guideline, one thing at a time. So we're discussing this motion, and we want to change it. So somebody proposes an amendment, which we represent by dimetrodon. So you amend a motion to improve it. The amendment applies to the main motion. The amendment must be germane, that means relevant. And anyone can move to amend, even the person who made the motion. You might look a little foolish if you make a motion and then are proposing an amendment a minute later, but you can. So the photographer says, I move that we amend the motion by adding the words, provided that the plan for each patio is approved by the design review board. So if it's adopted, it will read, the commission will recommend to council that residents will be authorized to build patios in their private yards, provided that the plan for each patio is approved by the design review board. Now, there are four ways to amend. You can add or insert words. You can strike out words. You can strike out words and insert words in their place, or you can substitute, which we don't recommend. The amendment is processed using the same eight steps that we just saw for a main motion. The challenge is, and I know you know this, but I have to say it, we vote on amendments before we vote on the main motion in order to make the main motion as good as possible, to perfect the motion. The amendment actually blocks the main motion. So we've got our main motion, authorized patios. We have an amendment adding the words provided approved by the design review board. We discuss the amendment. We vote on it. If it passes, it becomes a part of the main motion, and then we have an amended main motion. Or, if it fails, we toss it away and we go back to the main motion. People sometimes get confused and don't realize that after voting on the amendment, the process continues. And once the fate of the amendment has been decided, debate will continue on the main motion, and more amendments are possible. Once you've dealt with one amendment, you might have others, provided they apply to a different aspect of the main motion. It takes special actions, reconsideration, to go back and change something we've already amended. I'll rescue my dimetrodon here. So after all the amendments have been processed, the body still must vote on the amended main motion. Now, people sometimes use the phrase friendly amendment and process it the wrong way. Do not turn to the maker or seconder to ask if they accept the amendment. That gives them improper power. You handle a friendly amendment the same as any other amendment. You ask, is there a second, and keep on going. Because once a motion has been stated by the chair, the maker and the seconder have the same rights as anybody else. Can there be two motions related to the same issue? Well, the rules in Robert say that if we're considering one motion, that we have to stick with that until we're done with it. And that if it's failed, we cannot have another motion that is substantially the same. So it's going to be the chair's call as to whether the second motion is different. By the way, it's also fine to process a friendly amendment by unanimous consent. Is there any objection to adopting this amendment? Unanimous consent is a form of voting. It's a kind of fast track, and it's very efficient for minor procedural matters. The presider suggests something, and if you agree, you remain silent. Your silence means consent. If you don't want to proceed in this way, you say objection. objection, and then the presider abandons the fast track to use the regular method. So a good language tip is without objection, or if there is no objection. And in that way, you are acknowledging the authority of the group, but you're still helping to move things along. So let's look now at the authority and role of the chair and the members. Robert has different rules for small boards, up to about 12 people. In a small board, the chair may make motions, discuss, and vote unless law, regulations, or bylaws say otherwise. And in general, on your planning commissions or citizen advisory bodies, the chair should be participating. We recommend, however, that the chair exercise restraint by speaking and voting last in each round and by refraining from making motions. Instead, the chair can say, does any member care to move that? Note that the council sets the rules for commissions, boards, and committees, and members are bound by those rules unless and until they can request a change. In all of this, we're referring to Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised, 12th edition, which is abbreviated RONR. We recommend the spiral-bound editions from the National Association of Parliamentarians. It's also available in print Kindle from Amazon. Now, this is a very big book. It's more like a textbook than an actual guide. And I'm happy to say that the Robert's Rules people have prepared Robert's Rules of Order in brief. This is a good book. You can read it in a weekend, although nobody wants to. But I think it's helpful to have it. I'd like to talk now about two different types of organizations. One is shaped like a triangle or a pyramid and is called an accountability hierarchy. There's a boss who is in charge of the organization and who recruits people to do the organization, and if they do it badly, fires them. One feature of this is that it has layers of status or rank, and people who are near the boss are higher in status than people who are down below. To my mind, this is okay as long as they use their status intelligently and listen to the people down below, which they have a tendency not to do. So this is very common. Every company has a CEO, every army has a general, every school has a principal. It's so common that we sometimes think of it as the standard or default type of structure. But there's a whole other kind called a voluntary association. In a voluntary association, a group of people come together to achieve a common purpose. They set up some guidelines for themselves and they select a leader, but the leader is a peer. The leader is an equal with some special responsibilities. And your planning commission, city council, Rotary, Red Cross Board, HOA, those are all voluntary associations. In such an association, each member has an equal right to speak and to try to persuade others to accept their view. During meetings, the chair controls the process so the group can make the decision. And during meetings, the chair is the servant of the group and the group is the final authority. Now that's the most important thing I'm going to say today. The chair is the servant of the group and the group is the final authority. So you have both types of structure. The Planning Commission or Citizen Advisory Board forms a voluntary association. The mayor, the city manager, or the county executive and staff form an accountability hierarchy. They're quite different. What is each person's individual authority? When you walk out from your Planning Commission or Citizen Advisory meeting, how much power do you have? Well, you know the answer is zip, zero. And this is a wonderful formula for it, I think. All members of a governing board share in a joint and collective authority, which exists and can be exercised only when the group is in session. So what is your individual power? Well, people are often surprised at how little power they have, and you have to know the limits of your role. And you may not do the work of the city. We'll talk about some of that under the pitfalls. Now, during your meetings, discussion on your motions can and should be vigorous. Express your views freely and don't hold back. But once the vote has been taken, things change. It's okay to disagree. The fact that people have different opinions is a strength. It's a good thing. But we tend to identify with our own position, and when we're defeated, we sometimes take it personally. And this is a mistake, because at the end of the day, the body must unite behind its decision. It's a basic democratic principle that the decision of the majority, voting at a properly called meeting, is the decision of the body as a whole. And the minority must make it their decision as well. Now, this is a terrible system. It'd be better if you made me the grand poobah and I decided everything. But I hold with Winston Churchill, who famously said, democracy is the worst system of government in all the world, with the exception of those others that have been tried from time to time. When serving on a public body, members have a duty to uphold the decision of that body, even if they disagree with it. Members may express their disagreement in public, but they may not attempt to undermine the decision. And they're free to try to persuade their colleagues during the meeting to change the decision within certain limits. So we will send you a paper, Lost the Vote? Don't sabotage the council's action. And what is the alternative? I love this quote from Elias Canetti. The ballot box is sacred because the alternative is blood. All across the world, we see this. We see societies where decisions are made by blood and iron, by the force of power, and not by a genuine democratic citizen-involved process. And I love that about our nation, and I want to honor all of you on this call, both you resident and citizen volunteers and you staff members, because you are serving your community in a wonderful way, and it's not for personal gain, it's for your commitment, your care for your community. You're in the tradition of our founders and the best aspects of our democracy, and I salute you for it. Thank you so much. Now that's my public service announcement, and now we will jump ahead and talk about pitfalls. So there are pitfalls to serving on a planning commission or a citizen advisory committee. And I'm referring often to a planning commission, but this applies to all committees as well. And the first is to confusion about your job in general. It's not always the case, but in general, the work of the planning commission is to carry out the instructions of the council. It's not to take a hold of your topic and then come up with your own brilliant ideas about it. Now, what is a planning commission? A planning commission is a body that has been established in order to do a job assigned by someone else. And this can certainly be a problem for people. So there are a bunch of pitfalls. We've identified 9 here, and we're going to be reviewing quickly some examples of them. And you can think to yourself, which one is this? And if you've printed out the list, you can check it off. So here's the first situation, which really happened. The Planning Commission is considering a request to lower the setback from 50 feet to 20 feet. And a commissioner asks, isn't there a better place in the city to site this hotel? Well, that is the wrong question. You have to answer the questions assigned to you by the council, not propose unrelated alternatives. Next situation, the Environmental Commission is considering recommending setting aside some wetlands. And a commissioner says, oh, I think we can't address this until the university report comes out in 5 years. Well, we call that asking for the moon. It's an unfortunate fact of governance that sometimes bodies must make decisions with less than adequate information. Here's another situation. The staff have made a recommendation to purchase a historic farm site as a museum. And a commissioner says, why are the staff making this recommendation? I think we're wasting our money on staff resources, salaries. Only citizens really understand the issues here. Well, confusion about the role of the staff takes many forms. Obviously, we need staff. It wouldn't be possible for residents alone to conduct the business of a modern city. And there are other confusions as well, and we'll address those in Section 7. Situation, the staff has carried out a survey, and a commissioner says, since I'm a professional surveyor, I can redo the survey to verify it. Well, that's confusion about your job. A commissioner may have valuable particular expertise, but they're recruited to the commission as a citizen, not as a technical expert. Let staff be staff and citizens be citizens. There's been a public outcry about changes to the irrigation district boundaries, and the commissioner says, oh, six of my neighbors are very upset about this. They've taken the trouble to come to our meetings, so we should do what they want. Well, Rick Stevens, who came up with the original list, calls this deafened by decibels, being swayed by the emotional power of a presentation or the number of people there is a common problem. Decisions should be rational, not determined by decibels. Your responsibility is to listen to your constituents and taking their views into account while voting based on your own best judgment, not solely in response to crowd opinion. And we have another paper I'll send you, When Public Pressure is Intense, that talks about this. Next pitfall, there's mixed public opinion about a developer's plans to site a shopping center near the main road. And a commissioner says, oh, and we're getting so many conflicting views, I think we just punt for another 6 months. Rick Stevens calls that decision delay. A planning commission is expected to render decisions in a timely manner. Some applications suffer death by a thousand nicks, and you don't want to do that. The Arts Commission is considering a report about the museum, and the commissioner says, oh, I was on my honeymoon in Norway, and I just haven't had time to study this. Well, commissioners must read their packets before the meeting, as previously mentioned. The commission is discussing plans for a new hiking trail along the river. And the commissioner says, I think we have to analyze what kind of paving stones are best, so teeny tiny rocks don't get stuck in the paws of our dinosaur residents. We call this lost in the weeds or analysis paralysis. We all have a human tendency to delve into the details. And sometimes this leads commissions astray as they spend too much time discussing details that are not relevant to their assignment. There doesn't seem to be an attractive option for the new community swimming pool. Both sites have environmental issues. A commissioner says, the planning commission and the city can't resolve this issue. I move that we recommend that the city carry out a referendum. Well, if there are tough environmental issues, the public is not going to be the best authority to decide what to do. A commission should not shrink from hard choices. It doesn't have the right to decline to do its job. That's a waste of public resources. And my favorite, the last one, there's a lot of dubious activity going on in the 110-acre park to the east of town. And a commissioner says, I move that all parks commissioners be issued t-shirts saying Parks Commission and be authorized to issue tickets to offenders. Well, this guy was confused about the scope. Parks commissioners are not police officers. They have a much more limited job. So here is our list of pitfalls, and I hope it will be helpful to you, almost all of which I've encountered in real life, but if maybe they don't seem realistic to you. So let's look now at the role of the staff. So the staff are advisors to the body. They are not members of the body. Their participation is limited, but they do have the right to speak in order to fulfill their function of service. Staff members do not opine about the general discussion, but speak about their present topic as relevant. Staff members must seek recognition before speaking and must be prepared to speak up. Don't be shy. Here's an example. The commissioners have wandered off into the weeds and far from the topic. So a staff member can say, these are indeed important concerns, and at the same time, they're separate from the topic we're considering. I recommend we take them up at a later time. Now notice that in this suggested phrase, I did not use the word but. Never say but. The word but cuts off the emotional connection between you and the other person. You can always say and, even if it feels awkward. A discussion between a single commissioner and a staff member should not hijack the meeting. Sometimes meetings that commissioners and staff can go on for 15 minutes, and that's not right. We recommend that each commissioner may ask one or two questions, and then others have an opportunity. If it becomes a big problem in your commission, you could try a policy like this. In order to make the best use of time at meetings, commissioners are requested to send their questions about details of agenda items to the staff liaison as soon as possible after receipt of the agenda packet. The staff liaison will endeavor to prepare responses before the meeting when time permits and will share any responses via email with all commissioners. At meetings, commissioners may put additional questions on a given agenda item to the staff. The total time allotted to each commissioner for questions and answers on a given topic will be 10 minutes. Now, you're hoping you're not going to have each commissioner spending 10 minutes on each topic, but that's a reasonable length of time. Commissioners may not criticize the staff in public and must be courteous to them. This is an unequal power relationship, and a public meeting is not the place to raise performance issues. If you as a commissioner have concerns about the staff, speak to the mayor or city manager privately. The staff are employees of the city. The commission or the committee may not direct them independently of their assigned tasks. And staff have a duty to remind citizen volunteers of the laws, regulations, and fiscal constraints that apply. This is not sticking an oar in, it's doing their job. It's also very important for the commission to give clarity to the staff. You know, people sometimes say, oh, the staff can look into this. If you as an individual want the staff to do something, the presider must make sure that the commission agrees by taking a vote. The commission as a whole has the responsibility of giving clarity to the staff. You can simply say, I move that the staff research this. And if there's a second, and then take the vote. It's also important for commissions and committees to come to closure with their issue and define a specific action that they recommend. As mentioned, don't say, I move what he just said or so moved. And here, the staff can help bring things to closure by making a suggestion for a motion. I got this inquiry. Somebody wrote and said, some of the citizens in our area accuse the Planning Commission of being a rubber stamp for staff recommendations. How should we respond? Well, if you are considering staff recommendations seriously, if you have them enough in advance to study them and to ask questions and to propose amendments, and if you do your due diligence, and if you give serious deliberation, then this accusation is groundless. And you can say something like this. We on the Planning Commission work hard to review staff suggestions and give them careful scrutiny. We take our responsibility seriously and debate proposals, sometimes proposing amendments, before we vote on them. We are deeply committed to serving our community, and we stand by our work and the work of notice I did not say we're not a rubber stamp. Don't use that word not. Just say a positive statement about your work. And occasionally we do have staff overreaching. This is somebody wrote me. The administrator of the county planning department frequently interrupts the meetings to tell us what we can and cannot do. I feel he expects the commission to rubber stamp proposals from the planning department. Commissioners have asked to add agenda items but been told they can't, and he threatens that he will stop the meeting immediately and call the prosecuting attorney's office. So this is clearly a case of a staff person who is off the rails and needs to be brought back in. So here's another paper for you, Successful Staff Interaction in Local Government Meetings. And we're back now at our conclusion. Let's look at why do we need rules. Here is a quote from Richard Rohr. Win-lose is the only game most of us understand. We have a constant unspoken need for domination and actually find no enjoyment in win-win situations. I'm sure that's not true of you. I'm sure that everybody on this workshop is at a higher spiritual level. But as for me, if I'm in a fight, I want to win it. And so if you feel yourself on your body hardening into a combat position, remember that it's not a fight, and back up, soften up, and let yourself look for the win-win situation. This is our book, Mastering Council Meetings. It's available on Amazon, and you can also go to our website under books and order a sample excerpt from it. It's the only book I know of its kind that's designed for you, for staff and commissioners serving the public. So I'm including in your packet tomorrow Quick Guide to Planning Commissions and Quick Guide for Citizen Advisory Committees. And I'll also include a link to this publication by MRSC, Local Government Citizen Advisory Boards. So the recording will be sent about a week later, end of next week. So I said we were here to invigorate staff to support and volunteers to run effective Citizen Advisory Committee meetings to serve your community. I gave five things that you would be able to do after taking the workshop, and I listed four kinds of problems. So I do want to mention, we gave answers for 1, 2, and 3. I didn't say anything about 4. If you have commissioners outside the meeting who are attacking their colleagues on social media, you cannot censure them because of the First Amendment. You have to try moral persuasion. You have to speak with them or have someone else speak with them and point out that doing this weakens the commission and harms the work of the body and the work of the city. Try to appeal to the better side of their nature. It's not always possible, but you have to make a try. I'm going to close with this wonderful quote from Samuel Johnson. He said, "Kindness is within our power, liking is not." You cannot make yourself like your fellow commissioners, but you can be kind to them. And you must be kind to them because serving on a local government board is like being in a marriage arranged by the citizens. So thank you all for participating in this workshop. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I hope that it's been helpful. I look forward to seeing you at a future workshop, and all of us on the Jurassic Parliament team wish all the best to you in your important endeavors.
I'd like to complain about staff.
So hopefully you enjoyed the training, and you know, feel free to practice this training with your kids or grandkids with toy cars or dolls or whatever your preference is. So anyways, what'd you guys think? I'm curious. Yeah. Yeah, it is entertaining. And so this is the kickoff point where we won't be scripting anymore for Planning Commission. That was the direction we got. So if there's any concerns, you know, we've got Clara who can help with making motions, but I think people should generally understand how motions occur by now. But if not, we can assist. We're not going to let Planning Commission fail in any way. So any questions? Any thoughts? Okay. One last thing is I will be sending out notes from our joint meeting just to make sure that we're all on the same page. Yes?
I just wanted to say, because I'm positive that this is Aaron's last meeting. Thank you so much.
Right.
I didn't get a lot of time with you, but I appreciate your service to the county and all you've contributed. And yeah, I hope we do you proud in your succession.
I'll second that.
No one has to say all in favor, by the way.
I don't know.
That's no. Because we're not at good of the order yet.
Yeah.
I'll wait for that part.
I must at this time ask for any other general comments from the public. Hearing done, what do we have for the good of the order?
Yeah, I'd like to share an appreciation for Mr. Murphy. He, most of you haven't been around this group long enough, but he's been here well over a decade, survived two comprehensive plan wars, has been the person, I think, on the Planning Commission who is focused on answering the hard questions, both for the good of the staff and for making the decision-making of our county commissioners better. Aaron, I appreciate your leadership and your guidance throughout this process. Wish you well, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, I would just end by saying none of this works without team. And Scott, you're probably like Richard and I, one of the longest standing folks in the midst of quite a bit of change and turnover. So we appreciate you. We appreciate Clara being such a quick learner, jumping right in and taking that on. And to all of you, I would, just say that don't be afraid to be, challenging within the context of what you learned today as far as what is polite and fair. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask silly questions early so that you can ask educated ones later. And then I think as you've watched Richard, and Richard definitely was a mentor to me, it doesn't hurt that he's a real estate attorney as a background, but look for mentors, have conversations outside the room, and somehow try to find a balance between, fish and eagles and setbacks and water rising and the fact that none of that will matter if there's a homeless camp at the stream. So, that is the challenge. So, but thank you for allowing me to serve. It's been an honor. And I'm going to go serve somewhere else, and maybe you'll see me again if there's a hole in the dais.
I've got to pay you a compliment. It was it came from Commissioner Rolfes, and it was not direct, but it was her comment was, "Help me find somebody like Aaron as a replacement." So I think that's a pretty good compliment from the commissioner.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Other comments? Well, thank you for your service. Anything else for the good of the order? Done.
Just real quick, I heard you say that there may not be a meeting the first Tuesday of July, or there isn't a meeting the first Tuesday of July. Okay.
Yeah, and I will send out proper noticing for that as we get closer to that date.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.